If you're like me, you love and miss that golden era of Christian music. From the Jesus music of the 70s, the monster vocalists of the 80s, and the creativity and risk-taking of the 90s and early 2000s. I'm Andy Christman, and for the past four decades, I was privileged to be smack dab in the middle of this crazy and beautiful thing that we call CCM. As a member of the group For Him, I got to know so many great people with even greater stories, and I don't want to keep these stories to myself. That's why I created One Degree of Andy, so you can join me as I reminisce with my friends and colleagues. My hope is that as you experience these conversations, you'll go back and listen to that golden era of music and fall in love all over again, just like I have. This is the One Degree of Andy podcast. You've heard me say on this podcast so many times, you cannot tell the story of Christian music without dot, dot, dot. And if you go back a few episodes to my conversation with Jaron Davis, I said that you cannot tell the story of Andy Christman without Jaron Davis. Well, you cannot tell the story of For Him without Andy Ivey. He's my special guest today. He's been my friend for a very long time. Andy was our very first A&R guy and really helped shape us in the very beginning of our careers. So it's really, really fun for me to sit down with an old friend and talk shop. And there's a lot of really cool, just really behind the scenes details that if you're into that kind of stuff, you're going to love this episode with my friend, Andy Ivey. Hey, don't forget to head to my website this week, andychristman.com. There you can consider becoming a premium subscriber, which will get you early access to every episode and some exclusive video content. You can also check out my radio show called Worship with Andy Christman, which is on over 500 stations around the world each and every week. And don't forget to sign up for my newsletter as well. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. I'm all over the place. So reach out to me this week and let me know what you think about the podcast. Okay, here is my conversation with my very good friend, Andy Ivey. My friend, my bro, my namesake, a guy that I can't imagine this journey without. You were, Andy, you were our A&R guy for the beginning of our career, for the first few records, for, you know, really just getting us off the ground and where we were going. And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So welcome to my podcast, my friend Andy Ivey. Good to see you, my friend. I see some good little plaques back there like I have back here in mine. Yeah, we've got some of the same ones.
There's a few. Yeah. I appreciate what you say. And you and I go back a long, long way.
Yeah, we do.
Back into the Truth days and way back when. I think I get a little too much credit for you guys' success. I was just happy to be in the room, you know. It's like the old Nashville joke.
Sure.
You know, if you're in the room, you get a third, right?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And so, you know, when the song is written. And so I get that. I mean, we all put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it together. And I was just grateful. I was grateful to be a part of it.
Well, I'm not going to say you were the fifth hymn, but you were close in those days because you were just around all the time. You helped us make hard decisions. And, you know, we talked about this on several of these episodes. If it weren't for you, we would have never recorded Where There Is Faith. Because that's always a fun story.
Yeah.
Well, let's start there with that song, because again, where would For Him be without that song? And we wouldn't have had that song if it wasn't for you.
Well, that story then brings in a bunch of names that you and I both know and love. Billy Simon, to start with, who is, he remains one of my favorite songwriters and just an interesting dude. And Dan Keene, who at the time was at Metagreen Music, who, if you spent any time in the 80s and 90s around the Christian music business, you got to know and love Dan Keene, who just is one of the funniest human beings I've ever been around and just a tremendous guy. But I remember sitting in my office at Benson overlooking the river there, and we were talking about this first For Him record. I was hitting the streets like, I need songs. And of course, people were like, who is this group? And what, I don't even think we had a name at the time.
No, we didn't. Well, I want to talk about, I know we want to talk about Where There's Faith because I led you there, but you bring up something interesting about finding songs for this new group. I mean, what was the attitude at Benson? I mean, what was the,
I mean, was there like, hey, we're really excited about these guys? Or was it like, hey, we signed another artist. Let's try and find, what was the heat around us when we kind of entered the scene in the late, I guess it would have been like late 89.
Oh, it was earlier. It was 88.
Or 88. Wow. No, I mean, we recorded the record. No, we recorded the record in January of 90.
Okay.
So we would have been starting the conversations of breaking away from Truth and signing that deal with you guys, because Roger Breland went in and brokered the deal for us.
Yeah.
And I think he got a signing bonus or whatever, but it didn't go to us. It he might have gotten an advance, you know.
I can't remember all of the contracts. I was tangentially connected to that, but that was, you know, Lanny Cates and those guys in the legal department.
Yeah.
For the most part, who Lanny has carved out an amazing career for himself since those days too, and is an awesome guy. I remember the first time I had a discussion. I think it was Dan Clary and myself, and I think Jerry Park was in on that conversation.
Yeah, who was the president of Benson at the time.
President Benson at the time. Uh-huh. And, you know, because I had been working with you guys in Truth, and I just remember them saying, I don't remember who was the impetus for that conversation, whether it was Roger or Dan or whatever. I think everybody sort of knew you, Mark, Marty, and Kirk were probably nearing your end of your run with Truth.
Right.
And, you know, I'd seen you guys play so many times already, and there was always that moment where, you know, you guys did your thing musically on stage, and there's magic there. And Dan saw it as well. And I was sort of new into A&R. I'd come out of the radio promotion marketing side of it, but it had, you know, had a passion for the production. And you know, people tell me, and I think it's probably true, that I had an ear for hits. I just did. I knew when I heard a song that this is a song that people would want to hear. It would have some legs.
Which is a must have. I had a conversation with John Mays, and you know, same kind of thing. You know, you've got to have an ear for what is going to hit, not what is necessarily hitting now, but what is going to be a hit and fighting for it.
Yeah,
you got to have that. So you got to have that knower.
Yeah, I had a history of that with Benson, and even probably goes back to, you know, my first year in Nashville after moving. I graduated from college and moved to Nashville. I had a tutorial because I worked for Gaither Music Group, and it's like, you know, Gary McSpadden and Bill Gaither and Ron Griffin. And like, I learned some stuff that first year.
Man, Gary and Ron's name come up in almost every conversation.
Well, I mean, both of them legendary.
Yeah.
Gary was one of the kindest human beings I've ever met. Mm-hmm. And just loved him so much. I was at that first year. I mean, we're going backwards from Where There's Faith, but like that first year I was in Nashville. You know, I'm in the room with Billy Smiley, Gershmal, Eddie Carswell. They were all writers at this place, right? And I'm Chaz Bosarge and just an untold number. And I'm like, I'm hearing what makes a great song, you know, and understanding the building of a story. I had a really good, I didn't learn anything about music, about that kind of music in college. I learned about commercial music really that first year. I just had it was a paid internship. Is what it was. I wasn't making any money, but I was learning a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And just loved it, had a passion. And then I came to Benson and had a pretty good run, hearing albums that had been recorded going, that's a radio single. That one's not, that one has some potential. And demonstrated enough skill in that area to go, hey, maybe this guy might know a thing or two, right? And might have some potential.
Yeah.
And then I was also like, because I knew in the long run, I'd kind of figured it out. It's like, I don't know if I want to be in the marketing side my whole career. I think I really want to be the guy who helps create the product.
Yeah, be on the creative side. Yeah.
Build it. I wanted to be part of that. And so, but to do that, it's like, well, I need some experience. And so that's how I hung around. That's how I met Don Cook. And that's how I met Dave Clark. That's how I met Keith Compton and all those guys, because I was hanging around in the publishing area. Work would be done. I'd be downstairs in the studio going, teach me something. I want to hear this.
Yeah.
And I learned about recording and I learned about production. And I learned about all of that stuff and started, you know, producing custom albums on if I could talk a friend of mine into who want, I do want to make a record, I was like, well, let me help you. And then, you know, I would, you know, God bless them, because some of it probably wasn't all that great, but I learned some things, and I learned to bring in people who were way more talented than me to do it. And so I was just around great songs a lot, which brings us back to Dan Keane and the whole story of For Him. There was a lot of buzz about the talent of Euphoric guys. I mean, we were just talking about it. And remember the search of a name, that was a whole, I'm sure you've told that story on this podcast before. That was,
go back and listen. Go back and listen to the For Him podcast. It definitely,
exactly.
We definitely spent some time on that.
Yeah, I did listen to that. And, but so I'm calling publishers at this point. It was the Christian music business was a small world. I knew all the publishers. They all knew me. They knew that I was sort of the gateway for songs to get on recordings. And, but you know, with any new artist, it's always hard to get a publisher to give up a song, give you a song that they really think could be huge.
Yeah.
And I think it's okay to say this. I mean, what Dan told me, and you know, no big deal, I'm not name dropping here, but that song had been on hold for Amy Grant.
Wow.
And she just didn't, you know, it didn't hold, and then she didn't, Amy didn't record it.
Yeah.
It's, and because everybody's pitching a million songs.
Yeah. And she would have taken a hard look at it because, Billy had written a couple of big songs for her as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it wasn't just some guy coming up, you know, and an unknown writer handing their song.
And Billy always made great demos of his songs. At his home.
It was so fun. Yeah, it was so fun getting Billy's demos because, first of all, his voice was so quirky that it sold the most outrageous lyrical content and just the crazy places the song would go. You were like, this song is weird, but I really love his quirky voice on it, and I wonder what we could do with this song.
Well, I have there's a cassette tape in the room behind me right here that all the songs that, well, not all the songs, but a lot of songs that Billy and Wayne Kirkpatrick wrote and recorded together.
Run Amok. Yep.
I still have it. I will not get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because there are some diamonds in there.
Yeah.
One has ever heard.
Oh, yeah. Wayne sent me a Dropbox folder, and I've got it.
That Run Amok stuff is awesome.
Oh, it's so good. So good.
Yeah. I'll still go back. I have a cassette player back here, but this over here in this room, besides the weird stuff behind me, is my turntable.
Yeah.
And there's no digital stuff. And the receiver actually does receive Bluetooth, but I never use it. Mostly just turntable, but also a cassette deck. Because I have some gems that are still cassette.
Yeah, so. I do too. I've got a box somewhere in my attic that I need to probably rescue at some point. It's just all cassette tape. Because I know these are never be on CD. They'll never be on vinyl. And they're just rarities that, you know, you won't be able to find anywhere else. I'm going to have to at some point get those digitized and put them on a file somewhere so that, you know, after my demise, they will be available to whoever in my family wants them. But do you have old demos? Do you have any of those old demos from the songs we recorded from Billy?
I believe I do, somewhere in a box back here.
I would love to have some
diamonds in there that are amazing.
Yeah.
But I had put the word out to the publishers in Nashville that, hey, we're looking for songs for this new group. Four guys, don't think quartet, think pop, you know, think current radio. I probably had pitched some, I can't remember. I'm sure I pitched some, like, you know, mainstream artists that, hey, we're aiming in that direction. I remember the day Dan Keane, of course, when Dan walks in your office, it's, you know, gets your attention because he's about 6'4" or something.
Yeah.
Big tall guy. And he walks in and, you know, with his hair, I think he was about 6'7".
Yep.
And he sits down in my office.
Jeans and a sport coat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Always. And so he sits down in my office and we're talking about the group. He says, well, I brought a song that I think might be interesting. And I popped, you know, stereo's right behind me. I popped in the cassette deck, listened to it. My eyes got big. And I'm like, man, that's a hit. He goes, I know. And he says, can you believe Amy passed on it? I was like, no, I mean, everybody pitches her great song. I mean, and she's a brilliant writer on her own.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what the percentage of outside songs that Amy records, you know, over the history of her work, but, you know, it has to be pretty spectacular. And this song was, and I said, that's a hit. You know, and he goes, I know, right? And so I don't know, you guys were coming through town. I can't remember. Truth was coming through, and we were sitting, we'd had some booked some time to have a song meeting. And I remember playing it. We listened to, we probably listened to 8 or 10 songs that day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, it, you know, the hard part for me was like, everybody was pitching songs. Like, let me narrow this down to something that one fits. Each one of you had to have, you know, what, you know, songs for your lead.
Well, and here's the thing, even though we had been in Truth for, you know, 3 years before that, Mark a little bit longer and Kirk even longer, we were never part of song pitching meetings. Roger always did that on his own. And so it was really cool, but also really terrifying to say, oh, we've got to pick the songs for the record. And again, that's where someone like you comes along to be a big brother to us, to say, I know what I'm doing. Trust me. And, you know, we're going to find some big hits here. And I got to tell you, man, I mean, let's just say Where There's Faith didn't make the record. I mean, we still would have had some hits with Couldn't We Stand and He Will Be There for You. Maybe maybe another song off that record would have done well. But man, I don't think could have replaced the momentum that Where There Is Faith had on radio and establishing us as a group to listen to for decades to come.
Well, I think I even said something along those lines in that meeting when I played that song, because, you know, it's not competing interests is not the word, but Mark's a great writer, you know.
But he wasn't yet. I mean,
he was going to get there, though.
He was going to get there, and there were flashes of brilliance already, but we weren't going to be able to count on him to write the record yet.
And so I remember playing that song, and everyone's like, it wasn't the reaction I expected.
Yeah.
Because I'm like fired up. I'm like, this is a hit. We got to record this. And I'm like, wow, I'm getting sort of lukewarm reception to the song. And maybe it was the demo, because it was very specific to Billy, right?
It was. And that's what you got with his demos, was you had to be able to. And that's one thing we learned, was to be able to look past the demo to go, oh, this could be something totally different. And we hear the bones of it. I honestly, you know, later on, you know, Mark and Don would create these huge production demos, like the song's already produced. And I'd be like, stop producing this demo so much, because now I feel like we're locked into a sound and where the song could go. I just love the old days of hearing, you know, a song by Jeff Thurman or, you know, Sue Smith, or, you know, even one of Don's little demos, to where you could dream and go, what else could we do with this song? But when it's produced all the way out, you know, you kind of go. So I think that's another thing that probably did. You're right. It made us shy away from the song because it was such a specific production of what Billy had in his head. I also remember a comment of, I don't know which one of us said it, but it felt like it was very British, like it had a very European flavor to it.
It was like Tears for Fears meets, you know, Howard Jones.
Yeah. Which is crazy, because I'm a massive fan of Tears for Fears. And looking back on it now, I go, yeah, that totally makes sense. But coming from the Truth world, which was so choral, very right down the middle, it was left of center. And we were like, do we want to do something that left of center for our first thing to come out? Anyway,
I finally said, listen, guys, this is a hit and you're going to do it.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you played your A&R card and just went, I get the final say on this song. And I think that's the only song that you really like forced your hand on. The rest of it was all done in collaboration.
Yeah.
We thought the chorus was too long.
Yeah.
You know, we're just like, we don't get the payoff as, you know, soon enough. And that was a big thing for radio that we sort of understood. But again, without you guiding the ship there, without really fighting for that song, you know, I don't know that we would be where we are today.
Well, I think God's hand was on you guys regardless. And, you know, I was happy to play a part. I always think about the other song that I brought to you guys. This is a great story. I was talking to a buddy of mine who was in Christian radio for years and years and years. Mike Fernandez. I don't know if you remember Mike. Wonderful guy. Mike lives here in Atlanta. We talk once a month or so. Just a great guy. Funny guy. Biggest Monkees fan you'll ever meet.
Oh, wow.
And we were talking about this story, I don't know, a month or two ago, when you guys were in the room and I played you, I was thinking about what would be song for Kirk, you know, because all of you had fairly specific lanes musically, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. finding songs that fit each one of you to do a lead. was an important part of planning a For Him album. And I played you guys that Paul Davis song, Do Right.
Oh.
And I had, I don't know, I just always loved
you're,
that
you're song. You're just going to massage my heart here with that song.
Well, I loved that song. And I'd always heard it, thought, you know, that's really a Christian song. It had been a big pop hit. And I'd kind of, Paul Davis was a guy, you know, he was lived in Atlanta. I just kind of had, you know, I'm an Atlanta native. I don't know. I just felt like a connection. And I don't remember, I think Kirk immediately grasped it. Yeah, I can do that. Right.
Yeah.
And it was never a single, but it was always a moment in the concerts.
Yeah, it really was. I talked to Mark about that the other day. We're going to be doing some dates over the next few years, a few more dates just for him. And I'm like, I would love to bring that song back just because I think it still has legs. It really showcases. It's a great arrangement. Maybe update some of the sounds a little bit. But if I'm going to put on that first For Him record, that's one of the songs I'm really looking forward to.
Well, and Kurt goes, I know that he, and like,
yeah,
the opening line is like, yeah, yes, perfect song for Kirk.
And you know, we changed the lyric on that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because of our theological issue with, you've got to do right. Because you got to do right and he'll be your guiding light. If you do right, he'll be your guiding light. And we're like, no, you don't have, you know, sin's paid for, God's grace is on us. So we changed that lyric, which we probably shouldn't have in hindsight, you know.
Well, here's the thing. But, I don't know if you, did you know this? Or did I talk to you about this when we saw each other last month?
I don't know.
Paul Davis called me.
No.
You know, of course, the way this works for people who don't know who are listening to the podcast, a song that's been commercially recorded and released, you don't have to get permission to record it. It's, what's it called? It's the compulsory license, right?
Okay.
If it's been commercially released, then anybody else can record it. You have to pay the publisher and the writer.
Right.
So we send, hey, we're recording Do Right. We send it to the publisher. You know, get the compulsory license. We're, you know, so we're, they know that we know we owe you money. So I'm sitting in my office, maybe about the time the record's coming out, and so I answer my desk phone, Andy Ivey, hey man, this is Paul Davis. So,
oh man.
Hey, how you doing? You know, he goes, I just want to thank you for recording my song. This is a real blessing to me. I appreciate it.
Wow.
You know, you don't get those kind of phone calls. Wow. He was the nicest guy.
Oh.
And just, you know, thanked me for thinking about that song and giving it more life. And I told him, well, you know, I'm an Atlanta native. I kind of resonate with you. And he, oh, that's so cool. And, you know, he ended up passing away not just a few years later.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think about that was one of the nicest things to me was for Paul Davis to pick up the phone and make a point of calling me to thank you.
Such a string of hits in the late 70s and early 80s. And people listening to this don't know Paul Davis's music. Just go on your favorite streaming platform and start playing, you know, A Cool Night and, what's it? What's the big love song? He's got three or four. They're just like standard radio. It's especially on Yacht Rock too. Yacht Rock plays a lot of Paul.
Oh, Davis. Big time Yacht Rock. And I mean, everything had that percussive road sound from the late 70s, early 80s that, you know, was just on every hit. But Paul was a super nice guy. But yeah, that was kind of that thing where for me, as we approached For Him Records, was thinking, how do we make sure everybody has their moment to shine musically, lyrically, because, you know, the whole thing was, it's one thing to think about producing an album that's cohesive, it sounds good, it has radio hits, but also to think about how does it all come across live?
Yeah.
You know, that's your bread and butter. You know, you guys were probably playing two, three nights a week at times, you know?
Or more, yeah.
And, and you know, how do we build up quickly a catalog of songs for you guys to sustain the concert ministry?
Yeah. Well, and you were in a unique position too, to help us navigate this, is that I'm trying to think of another group that came before us where every member of the group got an equal share of the vocal on the record. And I struggle to find out or to remember a group like that. The Imperials weren't like that really. It was mostly Russ or, you know, later on, you know, Paul Smith or Tom Hemby or whoever was kind of that main.
Yeah, Ron. Really, it was Ron.
Really, yeah. Ron Hemby, sorry.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that was kind of a unique position to put you in as well, to go, well, we've got to represent. That was one of our stipulations, because we would sit down and go, okay, we got 9 songs on that first record. Everybody gets 2 leads, and then we do 1 all skate. And then that was the same way for most every record after that, was everyone's going to get at least 2 big moments on a record. And you know, we're not guaranteed singles, those songs be singles, but we're going to try and find the songs that fit each personality. And I think that was one of the beauties of For Him, and you know, really made us unique on the landscape of radio, and you know, that you could have an interesting concert every time you came to see us.
Well, and you said it, it actually got easier, you know, because when that first album came out and Where There's Faith was a number one hit, and everybody was like, what? You know, then when we began to talk about the next record, every publisher wanted a piece of that.
Yep.
Right. And then we started getting people's A stuff. I mean, God bless Dan King for bringing us an A number one song on a group no one had ever heard of.
But where did we go for the first big single on record number 2? Right back to Billy Simon.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Billy Simon, the first single was the man you'd write about, and that was one of his. Yeah. We were like, Billy, what else you got? And I think we did at least 2, maybe 3 of Billy's songs on that record. I know Puzzles.
Yeah, Puzzles
was on that record.
Man You Would Write About. I always loved The Man You Would Write About, just because, you know, so many Christian songs have been written about walking out your faith in a genuine way. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, it's like the whole, you know, when did the WWJD thing hit? It's like, that's at its core, I want to be a man that, you know, you think about the heroes of the Bible and why their story is in there, right? And some of them are like, whoa, that's a crazy story. But it all has its place in the formation, spiritual formation of our lives, right? And Billy hit it on the nose of, I want to live my life in such a way that people would write about my kingdom life, not my fame, not my fortune, not my whatever. And I loved that. I loved it for the lyric. I mean, Billy always has beautiful melodies and quirky melodies, like we were saying. But man, that was just so spot on. It's like, and convicting at times. But true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, Chisel Meets the Stone. Or was that on?
That was it.
Yeah. Is that on the third? Yeah. On the second record?
I believe that's the second record too. Yeah. So we went back to that well pretty hard for the second record.
Oh, that's because it was Chris Harris. Chris Harris produced that one.
Yeah.
So I actually sang. Yeah, I didn't sing a lead with Dawn on album number 2. I sang a lead that, because Reed Arvin produced, and we can talk about that here in a minute, how we chose producers for this project. And there's some pretty good producer stories I want to get to. I worked Reed Arvin with Man You'd Write About, and then I did Puzzles and Chisel Meets a Stone with Chris, I believe, with Chris Harris.
Yeah, that was Chris.
Yeah. So let's talk about that for a second. How the choosing of producers, you know, was always a negotiation. You know, I think that, you know, we wanted our wish list was some heavy hitters on album number 1. And we came to you with Chris Harris and Mark Heimerman because we were such big fans of those Prism albums. Even though they were kids' records, we were like, this is really pop sounding.
That was really high end children record production. Yes. It was very sophisticated, and you could hear the pop sensibilities that Chris and Mark always brought to the table. Mark still does. Well, Chris and Mark both still do really interesting stuff. Yeah. I kind of keep an eye on both of them and remain friends. I'm more in contact with Mark these days than I am Chris, but.
And that Mark Heimerman, it was pre-DC Talk days.
Yeah.
So we were still kind of getting him before he got massive and huge. And then the second record, he was out. We wanted them both back. And Chris was like, well, I'll do it. But Mark was like, I'm going to go on and do some other things over here. And he knew where he was going with that. Dawn was someone that my memory is, we didn't really know Dawn. I just remember saying, hey, we've got this new producer. He's been writing songs for us for a long time. I know he had produced a few things before For Him record, but it was kind of his first.
I don't think Don had produced anything that actually was commercially released before that first For Him.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, I talked to him not long ago before he passed, and He did mention that he had produced a couple other things before that first For Him record, but no, not the big commercial success that he had with us.
I had worked with Don a lot, and we just become friends. I mean, I hung out with him a lot. We kind of showed up at Benson at the same time. And, you know, had interesting life stories, and just we played a lot of golf together. And I just believed in his gifting a lot, not just his songwriting, but I would hear his demos.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he would come hang out in my office a lot, like, hey, what do you think of this? You know, what do you think of this? And I just kept hearing, like, this guy is way more than only a songwriter, which, don't get me wrong, being a songwriter is a big deal. Yeah. I'm not downplaying the importance of songwriters. I mean, you know, talk Natalie Hemby for a second, or
right.
that, or these days, just killing it. But the style that Don just lived in was great. And I thought, man, he needs a, and I had just gotten a break. I wanted to be in A&R in production, and I got a break. I mean, Jerry Park gave me, he says, all right, I'm going to give you this. Prove to me that you got something. Okay. And I felt like I should do the same thing for Don, because I loved him. I believe in his gift. And I knew that he was heading for big stuff.
Yeah.
And I just, like, we got to bring Don in this. And I knew that he would bring, Don as producer also brings in songs, songwriting, other songwriters that that we would need in the long run. And so we just always kind of said, let's, you know, a lot of people go, one producer, whole album, get it done. Like, you know what? We got these four guys who are really, who sing well as a unit, but also have very, your voice and Mark, very different. Completely different musical genre, really. You know, Kirk's just Kirk. Kirk never sings anything the same way twice.
He doesn't. Trust me, I've toured with him. Yeah.
And I know. But every time it's always good.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like, it's different, but dang, that was good too, you know?
Yeah.
And Marty, sometimes I don't even know how to describe.
We call him the freak.
Yeah. And so finding producers that could work with four really different kind of lead vocalists just took some effort. But I think it paid off in the long run. And also, you guys got exposed to different production styles. So you figure out, what do you like? How do you resonate with it? Because you know that, you know, you're locked in a studio with somebody for a long time, you better be able to get along with them. You know, and of course, you and I had the interesting experience of the world of Jonathan David Brown.
Well, I wanted to bring him up, and I wasn't sure kind of how to navigate the process, but you would tell us, I just remember some of the stories. Now, obviously, we were there recording with him, and look, we did, and we've told this on a couple of podcasts, that I think we were in town for 9 or 10 days.
It was
to put our vocals on the record. That was it. We weren't there for tracking. We weren't there for mixing, because we were out with Truth every day.
Yeah, so I'm there the whole time hearing it all, going, is this going to work? And I was nervous, because it's on me.
Sure.
To make sure that this is right for you.
Yeah. And so being at Jonathan David's place, and if you don't know who Jonathan David Brown is, legendary producer, Twyla Paris, Petra.
I don't know, everything. He had his hand in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. But he got in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah.
A little bit of legal trouble. I don't want to go down that road. Feel free to Google his name. I don't know what's out there. But it was kind of obvious to us in his home. And it wasn't, and let me just say, it wasn't anything sexual or anything like that.
No.
But just seeing some things around his home, we were like, yeah.
I'm sure somewhere there was a supply of like 2 years of prepackaged food in his home.
Yes.
Somewhere. Yeah. I suspect that there was.
Yeah.
I had heard Jonathan, you know, I had never used him before, but of course I knew who he was, heard tons of his stuff, and he pitched me. He heard about you guys, and he pitched me, said, hey, I'd like to be a part of that. Dang, this guy's got a long track history.
Yes, he does.
Producing out stuff that gets on the radio. And I was like, you know, of course, I didn't know much about him other than his history. And I thought, well, I think we should give it a shot. And, you know, it's like low risk, three songs. Okay, let's do it. But I remember sitting in the basement at Jonathan's house, listening to him And there you'd be on the MPC 60 over there programming like crazy. And it would be awesome.
Yeah.
And, but you could tell like this dude, his brain worked differently than all of everybody else, anybody I've ever known, musically gifted, but also kind of those, sometimes those musically gifted people can be some of those eccentric people.
Yes.
Ever.
Okay.
Ever
eccentric's a good word. Yeah. Yeah.
He was eccentric.
Yeah. We can kind of leave it at that.
Yeah.
And then So again, not to dwell on this, but I just think some of these stories are fascinating. That I remember a story about when, like, you know, there was some things happened at his home, and things were about to get confiscated from his home. Yeah. And do I have this story right that you somehow got in there and got masters?
Like, I got all the 2-inch masters and brought them back to Benson before anything happened. Somebody called me and said, dude, you guys got some assets over there. I would suggest you go get them now. And so I went over there and got.
And it wasn't just ours.
No, it was other stuff.
Yeah. Oh, it was tons of of masters for some big artists and big albums that were just in his basement.
In his basement.
Yeah.
And I remember, which is not a great way to store analog tape anyway, yeah. Which yeah. There's all sorts of stories about that. You know, so, okay. Do you know what the first gold album in Christian music ever was?
Hmm. Was it Benny Hester?
Dallas Home, Rise Again.
Really?
Or that's a live album with Rise Again on.
Oh, man.
Rise Again was such a
huge
song.
Part of my heritage, yeah.
Exactly. And Dallas, I worked with Dallas for many years. Uh-huh. Love that man so much. Just, I never met a more genuine Jesus follower mm-hmm. than Dallas Home.
I would agree.
So, quick off for him tangent story. So,
okay.
At some point, you know, we had Benson owned the masters that Rise Again album. We thought, and I think as the digital age is coming to CDs, like that album deserves a remix, remastering, put it on CD. So I went down to the vault at Benson, got the 2-inch masters for that album. And, you know, Brett Teagarden.
Oh, yeah.
Recording engineer, brilliant guy. Mm-hmm. I said, let's get Brett to remix it. He had connection to Dallas. I talked to Dallas about it. And so, yeah, I got 2-inch masters, gave him to Brett, said, hey, let's start working on remixes. You know, stay true to the album. It's a live album. You don't get crazy with it, but let's remix it, remaster it. And I remember the first day he's doing that, he calls me up, says, we have a problem. I said, what? He goes, you know, the way you used to wear analog tape, it needs to be climate controlled. And the vault at Benson was not climate controlled.
Oh, no.
Humid, you know, cold, hot. You know, depending on, you know, it's Nashville, it's hot, cold, it's everything. He says, I put that 2-inch master on my machine. And the moment I started, he says, emulsion started flaking off. I'm like, this is Christian music history, first gold album ever. Yeah. What are we going to do? So I remember I said, well, Brett, I think let's call Ampex, which is the manufacturer of the tape. Like, what do we do? And so he called me back and says, you're not going to believe what they told me to do. They told me to put it in my kitchen oven at 250 for about 4 hours.
No way.
And then take it out. And he goes, do we do that? I mean, I'm like, we could be destroying the actual masters of the first gold album ever in Christian music. I'm like, this is Ampex. This is he goes, they assured me this is how you do it and it'll be fine. I'm like, okay, we did it and it turned out great. And then we remixed it and mashed it. And that's where the CD for the Dallas Home and Praise live album came from. But we had to bake the tape.
Wow.
And Brett was nervous. I was nervous. Like, we could, you know, both be in serious trouble if this goes wrong. But
I remember Don was a puncher. Like, Don loved to punch in vocals. Oh, yeah. Whereas someone like Michael Amardian was more of a comper. So you would, you know, he would just record
them and fly
you 30 times and then fly it all together and make magic out of it. Don was adamant. I can hear a comp vocal a mile away. I want a punch. He wants it to, he wants the breaths to line up and he wants the emotion to line up from mm-hmm. line to line.
Yeah.
But at some point, you know, especially if you're not on your game, that tape starts to wear out. You can't punch it forever.
No.
You know, and tape starts to wear out. And I just remember many of those times, Don going, guys, we've got about 3 more times to get this because we're going to put a hole in the tape. And it's not like digital where you can do it limitless number of times and fix everything. You had a certain amount of time to get it. You had to sing it right because there was no tuning of the vocals. And, you know, it was, I mean, you had to know your stuff. And
dude, before Pro Tools and digital recording came out, I mean, that whole analog process, I mean, I can't tell you how many times me sitting there on the tape machine with the little tray and a razor blade.
Yeah.
I would physically cut the tape and then assemble it back together, take out a verse or take out this thing, you know, to shorten it for a single or whatever. The things we did with analog tape would freak out people who grew up in the digital recording age. It's just a whole different universe.
But how much better? I mean, I know we're old school saying this, but how much better does analog sound than digital sometimes? There's a, just feels like there's a depth to it. There's a warmth to it that digital has caught up. But, and I remember back in the day hearing, I think was the first all digitally recorded, mixed and mastered album ever was Sting's. It was his second record. And what wasn't Dream of the Blue Turtles? It was nothing, maybe Nothing Like the Sun.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. And I even remember back then. So that was like late 80s, early 90s, late 80s. And I remember I can hear a difference and I liked it. But then you get back and go, oh man, just all the, I don't know. It's almost like handcrafted furniture as opposed to something made by machine. I don't know.
I remember the first all digital studio in Nashville soundstage. Was that one, the soundstage? One, two, or three. I can't remember which one it was. They had a Mitsubishi 32 track digital machine and an SSL console. And I remember, this is like Randy Travis era, later than that. But I remember I was talking to a buddy of mine who worked for Warner Brothers Country, and they were talking about, hey, we recorded everything and mixed it on that SSL and the, and just sound, they said, it sounds harsh. Hmm. And then you go to somebody like Hank Williams at Master Mix, and then Hank's, you know, he puts the polish on it. It makes it sound like it was, you know, better. And Hank was great at that. One of the best mastering engineers I've ever seen. I think Hank mastered almost all of your records as well.
Yes, he did.
If I remember correctly.
Well, he was the guy. I mean, I would guess 90% of all the mastering in Nashville during that time was for Hank Williams.
You went through Hank and Master Mix, which was always an interesting process. I remember the first time I did that, I was like, this is a cool thing. It's like waxing your car, right?
Yeah.
You put the final shine on and you think the paint is perfect, and then it gets this wax, you know, it's like, oh, that looks great. Same thing with mastering. It's like, sounds really good. We're having the mix, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you go in Hank and he like, you know, you need a little more at about 450 hertz. You're like, you know, who can hear that? But when he adds it and then he compresses everything in the right way, it's like, dang, that's really good. I mean, yeah, now I see why you get paid to do this stuff, Hank. A good mastering engineer is well worth it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. What was the last record you A&R'd for us? Was it?
Christmas Album.
Was the Christmas Album. And that one just...
Which has a great story.
Okay, bring it. Bring your story.
So every year at Christmas, I mean, since I've been old enough to make my own Christmas music decisions, the very first album I listen to every year is Nat King Cole's Christmas Album.
Yeah.
That is my favorite Christmas album.
One of my favorites as well.
I love it. I start there. And I'm like, I refuse to listen to anything else until I've heard Nat King Cole Christmas. And so when we began talking about the Christmas album, I'm like, I think I talked to you guys first. I'm like, dude, let's get Ralph Carmichael. And it goes, you know, he did Nat King Cole. He did Bing Crosby. I mean, amongst a million other legendary orchestral arrangements, the guy was just legend, right? And of course started, was it Light Records? One of the Christian, started like one of the first Christian labels out in California. And I thought, let's get him in here. I remember he was in Nashville, he sat down in my office there that you sat in a million times. And he started telling me stories. And I was like, you know, I think when I told him I was interested, he went and listened to some For Him stuff. He goes, those guys are really good. I said, yeah, they are. And I said, you know, we don't want to do it. You know, it's not an all orchestral traditional Christmas album, but some of it, we would love to go there. And he started telling stories about Nat King Cole. And here I am, you know, Nat King Cole's one of my, not just Christmas artists, but just an artist. totally love his voice and everything. And I think about what he endured to be successful in his time. And I just admired him. And Ralph just sat there telling me actually what a fine human being, you know, Nat King Cole was. And that was just, I was like, I'm sitting here going, the guy who did all the orchestrations for Nat King Cole and Bing. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people think Bing Crosby's White Christmas is, I mean, it's legendary, right? Ralph did that too. He did all the orchestrations. And it's just, you know, that was for me, like, that was high point. You know, sit in an office with Ralph Carmichael and talk about orchestrating, you know, albums that I'd heard since I was old enough to recognize music, honestly, you know. And I know you guys had a great time.
We did. You know, we've told this story several times about that Christmas album. One of the things I really wanted to talk to Don about on the podcast that I did with him is just how that was the only album that Don did front to back for us.
Yeah.
As a full producer. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say that was my idea, but I feel like I was one of the first ones to say, hey, what if Don produced the whole thing?
I think I do recall that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember going, because we had a short amount of time to do it. And with specialty records, what was the other term? There's another term for it.
Seasonal record.
Yeah, a seasonal record.
Seasonal record. You got a really limited window to get it sold, mm-hmm. to get it in there. And then and then it's basically nobody cares about a Christmas album after Christmas Day that year. Right. And then next about October, you can give it another push, and try it again.
But we knew Don could get it done quickly, and we had done enough work with him with all of our producers. We didn't want to use somebody new. And to do multiple producers just sounded like it wasn't going to work for this record. And so I think it was just the perfect combination of Don overseeing the whole thing and producing it, writing a few songs for it, and then Ralph coming in. And again, what I've told on the podcast before was just being at Crate Circle when they were laying down the orchestration for what? I think it was five or six of the 10 songs that he put orchestration on. We could afford for him to do.
It wasn't cheap. And it wasn't cheap to have 100 orchestra players out there on the floor either.
No, but I'm telling you, timeless album. I get messages every single season.
It's a beautiful
from
Christmas
people
album.
Just saying it is part of our family's tradition. Thousands and thousands of people. But I just remember hearing his arrangements, going, "Oh no, we have to lay vocals. What are we going to do?" Like, it was so intricate and all these crazy things he was doing. I'm like, "How are we going to sing into this?" Because we weren't just block singers. You know, we weren't just going to sing block chords over everything. We were intricate singers as well, developing our own sound, doing these weird harmonies and, you know, overlays and, all these things coming in and out. And to me, it was terrifying and exciting at the same time. And that's the most fun I think I've ever had on a record was, number one, being under the gun and the clock ticking because we had to get back out on the road. And then just going, how are we going to fit our vocals into what Ralph just did? And I think that's what makes that record such a beautiful record, is because it all worked. It all worked together.
And, you know, the Christmas albums were always a little tricky picking the songs, because you're like, okay, some people are like me. If I buy a Christmas album, I honestly want it to be mostly songs that I already know. Not to discount their... Every year or two, I'll hear a new Christmas song. Oh, I like that. But for me, I know I'm super biased, but I think Strange Way to Save the World is deeply underrated.
Oh, yeah.
I love that song. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of it. I love the execution of it. And the weird part is I find myself playing it for people almost every year going, "Have you ever heard this?" And they go, "Wow, that's great." I'm going, "Yeah, everybody should have heard this." I mean, for me, that was a little bit of a frustration. He's like, "Why is that song not me?" No,
because
it is Mark. It was Mark, Don, Dave, wasn't it?
I think it's just Mark and Don. Mm-hmm. I would have to go back and look at the credits. Dave might have been on that. I wouldn't be surprised if Dave was on it.
Amazing song.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was kind of one of the last ones to kind of come in for the song selection process when we were collecting songs for the album. Mm-hmm. And then that the way it always happens, it's kind of the last one to the table that ends up being there.
Everybody goes, "Oh, we got to do that."
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing, Andy, that I really appreciate about those early days of Benson, and it all changed, I think, because once we hired Mike Atkins as a manager, we didn't have a manager those first few years and those first few albums, which is nuts on our part. But also, there was something beautiful about it because it felt like family. I mean, you were like family to us, Dennis Disney, Dan Lynch, even Jerry Park, you know, for the limited amount of time we got to spend around him. It felt like family and that we were doing things like a family and like friends. And obviously there was a business aspect to it, and you guys needed to make money and we wanted to make royalties, and there's negotiations and all that kind of stuff in there. You know, you bring a manager in and the manager goes, "Hey, you don't need to be friends with the label. We need to, you need me in the middle." And, you know, but, you know, I just remember there were a lot of times at your house just hanging out. There were a lot of just hanging out at dinner and, you know, just going to movies together, and you would come out on the road and hang out with us. And that's what, you know, I think all artists that I talk to, when they talk about the great A&R people that worked with them, they have that. They have that sort of relationship where it feels like we're on the same team, not just same team, but the same family, just cheering each other on to great things. Even though, look, we're benefiting financially from the relationship, there is something that we go to war together to make these records and to get these things done. And I mean, even the fact that I'm looking right now at the debut album cover, and we're wearing your clothes.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, Mark and Kirk were kind of my size, and I was laughing about that. Everyone else here going, "Oh yeah, that's my sweater, or that's my coat. That brown leather jacket that Kirk wore, that's mine."
I can remember putting that sweater vest on, or that kind of sweater vest, and I remember it being about at least one size too big, and so that's why most of it's cropped out. But I'd just look at that and go, yeah, I don't remember any of those clothes, us buying them or ever wearing them again, because we worked on such a shoestring budget. I feel like that we made that record for around $30,000.
No. The first record we made, this is how the budget, we spent $45,000 on the first record.
Okay.
We spent $60,000 on the second record.
Okay.
And then basics, we had $100,000.
Yeah. I know it kept going up well because we're selling more.
Yeah, selling more. But you know, one time it was about, I think, you know, Jerry Park and I were really good friends. We played golf together often a Saturday morning. You know, we worked together all week, and then Saturday morning we're at Forest Crossing Golf Course in Franklin playing golf together.
Yep.
And I remember one time, and so Jerry and I were, you know, I count Jerry as a friend of mine. Even then, he was, you know, older than me, but, you know, believed in me, and I thanked him. But one time he called me in his office, you know, "Oh, great, I'm getting called into the CEO's office." And he goes, "Do I need to remind you that you work, your paycheck is from Benson, not from 4M? He goes, "I know you're close to those guys, but you work for us, you know?" And that does reflect the fact that, you know, I counted all four of you guys as dear friends of mine, and I wanted you to succeed. I wanted you to succeed so much that I just, you know, more than once I was accused of like, "Are you keeping the best interests of your employer?" I said, "Well, you know," look, "here's the thing. If 4M succeeds, we will succeed."
That's right.
And this is how we have to look at it. If we make sure those guys are super successful, the Mike Gay and all the salespeople are going to be really happy because they're going to be selling a bunch of copies.
That's right.
And I said, "That's what we want. You know, right. I want their royalties to grow because that means we're selling more."
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's always an interesting balance. And, you know, in Nashville, it's sort of like, you know, there's as many drummer jokes as there are A&R guy jokes.
And I love drummer jokes. Bass player jokes.
Yeah. Just pick your poison. There's a joke, you know, and, but I always felt like I wanted to work with my friends, and Dallas Holm was one of the kindest people, and his wife, Linda, who recently passed.
Yeah.
Linda was always so kind to me, and Dallas as well always was. You know, Matthew Ward was one of the most unusual people ever. Mm. He also lived out there in Lindale, Texas.
Yeah.
Loved Matthew, funny guy. And, but I worked with people that I really enjoyed being around. You know, Al Denson was a circus wherever he went.
Oh, yeah.
But it was
still
fun.
Still is.
Yeah. Still is, but it was fun. And, you know, he just had that, you know, when he'd make some outlandish proposal and he'd have that smile on his face, like, okay, let's give it a try. You know?
Yeah.
And the guy just, you know, he's the consummate deal maker and made things work. And it was interesting. I enjoyed hanging out with Al. You know, Billy and Sarah Gaines to this day. Billy mm-hmm. Gaines is one of my closest friends.
Wonderful, wonderful guy.
I spend a lot of time with Billy. I probably, when I was a single man living in Nashville, I've made more meals at the Gaines dinner table than anywhere else. Mm. I still, you know, Billy and I talk, I don't know, once every couple of months, one of us will call the other and check in. Or we've, you know, when I get to Nashville, I try to always see Billy. You know, Billy Gaines is one of those people like, you know, has spoken into my life in really meaningful ways over the years. So, yeah, I got to work with a lot of people that I genuinely loved. And it just so happened that, you know, commerce brought us together, but it really worked well.
Let's talk about your exit from Nashville and the music industry and Benson, especially. Can you kind of walk us through that? And because I think, you know, one of the really great, I think, attributes of this podcast is everybody I talk to is they're older, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old. And the heyday of their Christian music career is way back in the rearview mirror, but God continued to use them. They kept finding the next thing God wanted them to do. And I think that's the fear of every artist or anyone that works in the music industry is, well, what if I get cut? What if I lose my job? What if nobody wants to hire me as a musician or an industry person anymore? What do I do now? And I think that's probably the case for anybody in any walk of life. What happens if I don't get to do this anymore? Is there something else for me to do that I'm going to love?
Well, I'll try to tell the story as quickly as I can. You know, I grew up in a family that, you know, my dad was a Delta pilot but my dad was, you know, that was what he did to make a living and take care of his family. He was a minister and a, you know, ministry leader. He started a ministry called Fellowship of Christian Airline Personnel, which is a workplace evangelism and discipleship ministry still thriving to this day. And the church that, my oldest sister and her husband and family, where we all went to, started in our home in 1971.
Wow.
And when we would between pastors, it would, you know, dad would pastor the church, you know, he was just a minister who had a, you know, regular gig. Right. And so I grew up with that sort of ministry, example being set for me and for all four of us. I'm the youngest of four. And you and I, you know, the guys and I, we went to the Dominican Republic with Compassion International. And
right.
I had that experience together and I had kind of, you know, my oldest sister and her husband had lived in the DR for 2 years as medical missionaries. And so I had an affinity for it. And I came back going, wow, Compassion really does what they say they do. And it's really cool and it's beautiful. And then about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months after that trip, a couple of the guys, you remember Tom Beard, who played keyboards for GLAAD?
Yep.
Just one of the most beautiful souls. He and another guy came to my office in Nashville one day. They said, because I told them, hey, I'd really like to volunteer for you guys and help you out, whatever I could do. And they said, we don't want you to volunteer for us. We'd like you to consider coming to work for Compassion. I was like, okay. And so as you know, anybody who's watching this podcast, I'm a pretty big outdoorsman. It's like, you know, I grew up that way in the country. And I thought to myself, you know, living in Colorado might be kind of cool. I can fly fish and, you know, ski, And so I explored it and it just seemed like God just kept saying, this is, you need to go. And I got some things I want to do with your life. Okay. And so I go to Compassion, move to Colorado Springs. And, very quickly, what I discovered was I thought I would probably live in Nashville the rest of my life. It was, it had become my adopted hometown. Mm-hmm. But what I discovered was that God had a whole different career track ministry for me. And what I discovered was I love raising money to fund the kingdom. And I got to have a really broad experience with Compassion, understanding what it is that a Christian ministry does to function and to flourish and to grow. And
which, you know, can I say, I mean, I see the parallel between what you're doing as an A&R guy and raising money for, you know, a ministry like Compassion International. You know, you just talked about going, hey, let's spend more money. Let's spend more money. But why? Each record, because why? Because it pushes that ministry for him even farther than we did last year or the last record. And so that feels to me like, as you're telling that, man, what a great little parallel journey that was for you.
It was really good. And God really worked on my heart there. And I got mentored and got to work with people like Wes Stafford, who was the president of Compassion at the time. It's just one of my heroes. And his story is, his personal story, for people who don't know, just look up Wes Stafford. He's got several books, but his story growing up as a missionary kid in the West Coast of Africa, an amazing story. But it just solidified in my mind that God had a different plan for me. And I've followed that journey pretty much ever since. Today I work for an organization called Honduras Outreach, and we own a ranch in Honduras, it's a couple thousand acres. But from that base, we just demonstrate the love of Jesus to the most, you know what it is, it's the poorest of the poor, but also some of the most beautiful human beings you'll ever experience. And so I kind of run the U.S. operations and help find the funding for this beautiful ministry that just does very significant things in the lives of people. We provide basically the primary health care for, last year we served 25,000 people. We have a clinic on our, own a ranch. We have a clinic there, a medical clinic with a doctor who's been with us for 30 years, Dr. Herman, who's been with us for 30 years. You know, I was there a few weeks ago and on the morning, and these people are lined up to see the doctor. And we have an orthodontist there, a dentist. We have our own pharmacy there. These people come and we demonstrate the tangible hands and feet of Jesus to them. We have a spiritual director there. Basically, we brought Young Life to Honduras.
Oh, wow.
And so we have a great partnership with Young Life, really making a difference because, you know, people, you know, young men growing up in Honduras without a whole lot of potential are very easily swayed into gang life and that sort of thing. And Young Life is a great partnership for us. So there's that medical component, the spiritual component. We church groups come. Now, you and I talked about this because I'm going to get you down there with some of these worship leaders. We do just, you know, hands and feet of Jesus. People need clean water to be healthy. Mm. They need, sanitation facilities that provide for healthy existence. So church groups come down and build, you know, toilets and septic tanks and, you know, fresh water, what we call a pila, which is a place where they, you know, it stores fresh water, clean water, and they can access it, you know, there at their home. So we do that. And I just, I realized, you know, years ago that, you know, maybe the skill sets that God gave me, and my degree was in marketing, right? Maybe what my really real calling is to, I like to say this, and I can't take credit for it. Another ministry fundraiser told me this. He says, God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. He just needs some cowboys to go rope them in, bring them in, right? Kind of what I do. My job is to find kingdom-minded people with resources and match them to what God is doing. You've seen this. I mean, let me tell this story. It's kind of funny. You know, everybody who's been to an airport at some point, you've seen like clearly a church group going on a mission trip.
Yep.
They all got their t-shirt on. It says, and I remember a friend of mine saw this. I didn't see this, but he's told the story and I know he tells the truth. They all had a shirt on. It says, whatever the church was. And it says, taking Jesus to Costa Rica. And I'm like, dude, you know, Jesus was there before.
He's already there. Right? Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, but you know, so what I love about what I do is that it's just joining Jesus in the mission that he's already created, that his people are already there. The Holy Spirit is already working amongst the people. And we're bringing the kingdom resources to say, okay, how do we get, you know, how do we take these people, on a journey with Jesus to go, you know, here's the tangible hands and feet of Jesus working in this community. How do we join with him in that work? And so I get to do that. It's a blessing. I was, like I said, I was just down there a couple of weeks ago. So one of the other things we do, we have a program called the First 1,000 Days of Life. And what we discovered in the Olancho State, which is the state where our ranch is based, is that kids just weren't getting out of decent nutrition. You were talking about three-year-olds that weighed 20 pounds. Mm. And they weren't getting any protein, any kind of animal protein in their diet. So we started a program called the First 1,000 Days of Life, and we built a chicken coop on the ranch. And right now we have about 400 layer birds in there.
Wow.
What happens is these kids, when their mom becomes pregnant, they start getting an egg a day. Cook it any way you want it, but you get an egg a day for that. And when the kid's born, again, basically it's about a three-year plus 1,000 days, right?
Yeah.
Egg a day. And what we're finding was physical development, mental development was tracking where it's supposed to be because of just that little addition of protein in their life, which it's a small thing. It's an egg, right?
That's beautiful.
So that's practical. They say, because, there's a saying, I think I heard it with you when we were in the Dominican Republic, because did that Haitian Bate that we visited.
Right.
They were saying that there's a saying in Creole French, and I heard it in Haiti when I visited Haiti. It's like, an empty stomach has no ears for the gospel. Mm. And if you don't meet the real tangible physical needs, then don't tell me Jesus loves me if my child, is in terrible physical health and I can't do anything about it, but you could help me. It's the story of the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan, right?
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And so I get the joy of being a part of that. And I turned 60 this year. I'm 60.
My
dad turned 60.
You're so old.
Well, it's funny. When he was with Delta Airlines, man, back then at 60, every pilot had to retire.
Yeah.
He was done. Mm-hmm. And here I am, getting on planes and flying to Honduras and meeting some of the most beautiful people I've ever known. Mm. And I get to keep doing that. But, I did do this. Dad was a Delta pilot. My brother has been a corporate pilot for forever. I decided at 59 I was getting my pilot's license. So, I'm just about to finish that up. So,
okay. Well, let me know. Come down to Tulsa.
I'll fly down to Tulsa.
We'll go for a ride. We'll play some golf. So if someone's listening to this and they feel the Holy Spirit encouraging them to support or give to what you're doing, what's the website that they can go to?
It's just hoi.org.
hoi.org.
Yeah, Honduras Outreach, Inc. And founded 35 years ago by a guy who just God put this property in his lap and was like, do something with it. And a couple of founders who had big vision thought we could do some great things there. And so we would love for people to join with us. If you're part of a church group and you want to have a really meaningful short-term mission trip, that's really what we're good at. Pre-pandemic, we were taking 60 church groups a year down there. We have dorms and the whole deal.
Yeah.
Dining hall facilities and all that kind of stuff. We've got a group that leaves, here in Atlanta from Atlanta, on Saturday. There's about 50 people, all going just to, do beautiful things in the community. Mm. We're really good at that. So if people want to go as a church group, if they want to give support the work, we have that main clinic on the campus. We also have four of the remote health clinics, way out in the mountains. We're in this beautiful valley in the mountains of Honduras. They can give to support that work, support the work of our spiritual life growth work. We provide a lot of jobs. We have a running operating dairy farm operation.
Oh, that's cool. Wow.
Milk. We raise a lot of crops that gives people jobs around the area. So it's just, again, the hands and feet of Jesus at work amongst people, who lack some material resources, but as you know, are some of the kindest, most beautiful souls that God ever made. And so, visit hoi.org and there's a donate, page right at the top. You're welcome. We need more people to help us expand that work. So,
absolutely. Well, I love you, brother. And, I'm so excited about what God has you doing in this season of your life. And, I think if you're your palms up going, God, what do you want me to do? I mean, there's no end to what he can lay in front of you. And if you're willing to go, and man, it's going to be an exciting journey. And I know we could stay on here another 2 hours, and we should probably do it again sometime. We got to, you know, maybe.
Yeah, we scratched the surface.
A small fraction of the stories that you have to tell, which I know my listeners just, they love a lot of the inside detail, because it's, you know, it's, nobody's really talked about it much in this format. But again, I hope to see you soon. You know, it was great seeing you at
well, I told you I'd come see you. And so I will, and we'll play some golf, and we'll talk about, you know, we could use some worship leaders coming to the ranch.
We're going
to
do it. Oh yeah. I'm going to bring the table down there at some point.
Yeah. That'd be awesome. We would love that. Yeah. We would love that. Well, man, thank you so much. I, you know, of course I was so thrilled to spend some time with you last month in Nashville, you know, even though it was a, you know, losing our dear friend Don, but, you know, I think he would have been very happy I was sad that Marty wasn't there, but yeah. You and Mark and Kirk and me standing there, you know, just like kind of the old days. Mm-hmm. I know that Don was happy to know that we were standing there, not only telling stories about him, but enjoying what God allowed us to do together. That's for me. That's the story.
Hey, thanks for listening. Join me every Monday for new stories from the Christian music industry and beyond. And if you want more content like this, along with a lot of great music, join me for Worship with Andy Christman, airing on 500 stations around the world every weekend. And when you get a sec, run over to my website, andychristman.net, for information about my professional vocal coaching and an incredible new resource for worship pastors called The Worship Table. See you next time on the One Degree of Andy podcast.